Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're venturing into a really complex and often intensely debated topic, abortion. We'll be sifting through the philosophical and legal layers of this issue, all sparked by a thought-provoking lecture you shared with us.
It's definitely a sensitive area, and right from the start, it's important to say that our aim isn't to, you know, champion any particular stance. Instead, we want to thoroughly understand the different perspectives and arguments laid out in the source material.
Exactly. We're going to unpack the biological journey of how a pregnancy develops, look at the different ways abortion is understood, and then really sink our teeth into two significant moral arguments that are often made in support of the pro-choice position. This entire exploration is rooted in the Spiegel Ethics and Says 10.pdf lecture you provided. So our mission with this deep dive is basically to extract the core reasoning presented in that lecture to give you, and frankly ourselves, a clearer grasp of the philosophical ideas that underpin this ongoing discussion. Okay, let's unpack this, starting with the biological foundation. What's the sequence of events after fertilization?
The lecture provides a pretty clear picture of this. It begins, obviously, with fertilization, which creates a zygote. This single cell then undergoes rapid division and develops into what's called a blastocyst as it journeys towards the uterus. Think of this initial phase as the very first sort of building blocks being put in place.
Right. And then we move into the embryonic stage. What are the key developments happening there?
So the embryonic period spans roughly from weeks 3 to 8. A really significant development happens around week 3.5 when the heart starts to beat, although it usually becomes detectable by ultrasound only around the 6th week.
Okay.
Then around the 7th week, the brain begins to show activity. And at this point, the developing entity is termed a fetus.
Wow. It's remarkable how much happens in those early weeks. And there are a couple more key stages the lecture highlights, aren't there?
Yes. Around the 16th week, something called quickening occurs. That's when the pregnant person typically starts to feel the fetus moving. It's a noticeable milestone. And then around the 24th week, we reach what's termed viability, which basically means the fetus has a chance of surviving outside the womb if born prematurely, though usually with significant medical help.
Right, viability.
The lecture also included visual aids, you know, images illustrating these different stages, which I imagine helped to make these developments more concrete for the students.
Absolutely. Seeing those visuals can really put things into perspective. Now, the lecture then shifts to how we categorize abortion. It seems there's a fundamental distinction to be made right at the outset.
Precisely. The primary distinction is between the general term termination of pregnancy and the specific ways this can happen.
Yeah.
Within that, the really crucial split is between spontaneous abortions, which are miscarriages, you know, not generally part of this moral debate,
right,
and externally induced abortions, which, of course, are at the heart of the discussion.
And the lecture outlines a range of methods for externally induced abortion.
Yeah.
Could you briefly walk us through those?
Certainly. The lecture mentions several medical or surgical procedures: vacuum aspiration, dilation and curettage, often referred to as DNC.
DNC, yeah.
Saline injection, hysterotomy, prostaglandin, and also the morning after pill is mentioned in that context. These are the various ways a pregnancy can be intentionally ended.
Okay, so with that biological and procedural context established, the lecture moves into the really naughty part, the central philosophical issues. And it seems to boil down to two fundamental questions.
That's right. The first delves into the ontological status of the fetus. To put it simply, think of ontological status as asking, what kind of thing is it? You know, at each stage of gestation, are we talking about just biological tissue, something with the potential to become a human, something that's biologically human, but not yet what we consider a person, or a fully human person right from the moment of fertilization or blastocyst formation?
Those are some drastically different ways of understanding what a fetus is. And it makes intuitive sense that how we answer that first question will heavily shape our answer to the second.
Exactly. The second question addresses the moral status of the fetus. What rights, if any, does it possess? And what moral duties do we as a society and as individuals have towards it? As the lecture emphasizes, our understanding of the fetus's ontological status directly informs our views on its moral status. It's hard to separate them.
It's a logical progression, yeah. The lecture then provides some crucial legal background with the landmark Roe v. Wade Supreme Court decision. This is, I mean, a cornerstone of the legal discussion here in the U.S. Can you give us the essential takeaways from that ruling?
Roe v. Wade in 1973 was indeed a pivotal moment. The Supreme Court's decision established what's known as the trimester framework. In the first trimester, states were essentially prohibited from regulating abortion. In the second trimester, states could implement regulations, but only if they were aimed at protecting the mother's health. And in the third trimester, states could even prohibit abortions altogether, except when necessary to save the mother's life or health.
And Roe v. Wade wasn't an isolated case, was it? There were subsequent legal challenges and decisions that further defined the legal landscape.
Oh, yeah. Several significant cases followed. Doe v. Bolton, which was actually decided in 1973 alongside Roe, broadened the definition of mother's health to include not just physical, but also psychological and emotional well-being. That was quite expansive.
Right.
Then Planned Parenthood v. Danforth in 1977 established that neither parental nor spousal consent could be mandated, leaving the decision essentially to the pregnant individual and their physician.
And then we see further developments in the late 80s and early 90s.
Precisely. Webster v. Reproductive Health Services in 1989 saw the Supreme Court uphold a Missouri law that included a preamble stating that life begins at conception and significantly prohibited the use of public funds for abortions.
Ah, the funding aspect.
Yes. Then, in 1992, Planned Parenthood v. Casey upheld the constitutionality of things like a 24-hour waiting period and parental consent requirements for minors seeking abortions, but it struck down the requirement for spousal notification. So, a bit of a mixed bag there.
It's really clear from all these legal rulings that there's a distinct legal dimension to this issue, and it operates somewhat separately from the underlying moral considerations. The lecture makes a point of highlighting that distinction, doesn't it?
It does. It's absolutely crucial to differentiate between the legal question, should abortion be legally permissible, and the moral question, when, if ever, is abortion morally justifiable? You know, an individual can hold various combinations of views, for instance, personally believing that abortion is morally wrong in most cases, but also supporting the legal right to have one. However, the lecture makes it clear that the focus of our deep dive today will primarily be on exploring that moral question.
Okay. That perfectly sets the stage for us to delve into those moral arguments in favor of the pro-choice position that were presented in the lecture. And it specifically highlights Judith Jarvis Thompson and Marianne Warren as two key thinkers who have really shaped this discussion. Let's start with Thompson. Her arguments are described as quite distinctive.
They are. What's fascinating about Thompson's approach is that she takes a somewhat unusual starting point. For the sake of her argument, she actually assumes that the fetus is a fully human person, essentially granting it the highest possible ontological status right from the outset.
That's a really interesting move. So even if we grant that premise, she still argues for the moral permissibility of abortion in certain circumstances. Is that right?
That's precisely her strategy. She uses these really vivid thought experiments to challenge the idea that even if the fetus has a right to life, that right automatically outweighs all other considerations, particularly the pregnant person's right to bodily autonomy.
Bodily autonomy.
Yeah. The first and most famous of these is the violinist scenario.
Right. The one where you suddenly find yourself biologically linked to a world-renowned musician. Can you walk us through that thought experiment again?
Sure. Imagine waking up in a hospital bed, finding yourself involuntarily connected via tubes to a famous violinist who has a rare and life-threatening kidney ailment. You are the only person with the right blood type to save them.
Okay.
You were kidnapped and surgically connected while unconscious, and you're told by the Society of Music Lovers that you must remain connected for 9 months for the violinist to survive. Thompson poses the question, does the violinist's right to life obligate you to remain connected, even though you never consented to this situation, and it profoundly impacts your life, your freedom?
And her argument is?
Her argument is that it does not. You have a right to disconnect yourself, even if that means the violinist will die, emphasizing the fundamental right to bodily autonomy over an imposed obligation, however dire the other person's need.
It's a really powerful analogy. And as the lecture points out, it seems to directly address situations like pregnancies resulting from rape, where there's a clear lack of consent.
Exactly. That's often seen as its strongest application. But Thompson doesn't stop there. She introduces another thought experiment involving people seeds.
People seeds. Okay, explain that one.
Yes, the people seeds scenario shifts the context to think about situations where pregnancy occurs despite precautions, like failed contraception. Imagine a world where tiny invisible seeds drift through the air like pollen, and they can take root in your carpets or furniture, growing into human persons.
Wow, okay.
People in this world install special mesh screens on their windows those that are, say, 99% effective at preventing these seeds from entering and implanting, but occasionally, you know, one slips through the mesh and begins to grow. Thompson asks whether a woman in this scenario who took reasonable precautions but still finds a person plant growing in her apartment has the moral right to uproot it.
And her argument, as I understand it from the lecture notes, is that she does have that right.
Exactly. She argues that just as the woman has the right to remove the person plant from her home, despite it being a person by assumption, a woman who becomes pregnant, despite using contraception, has the right to have an abortion. This then leads into her discussion about different levels of what she calls Samaritanism.
Right. The minimally decent versus good or splendid Samaritans. Can you explain that distinction in the context of her argument?
Sure. Thompson argues that we have a moral duty to be what she calls minimally decent Samaritans, basically, to provide basic assistance to others when doing so doesn't impose a significant undue burden on us.
Mm-hmm.
She contrasts this with being a good or splendid Samaritan, which involves going well above and beyond what is minimally required, maybe at great personal cost. The famous case of Kitty Genovese, where numerous people supposedly heard her cries for help but did nothing, is often cited as an example of a failure to be even minimally decent.
Okay, I remember that case.
Similarly, laws that might require us to, say, throw a rope to someone drowning if it's easy to do so, exemplify this minimal level of expected decency. Thompson's contention is that laws restricting abortion, especially in cases of failed contraception, demand more than just minimal decency. They impose an excessive, prolonged, and profound burden on the pregnant person.
But the lecture also raises a really important counterargument to this, doesn't it? Couldn't allowing a fetus, even if we accept Thompson's premise that it's a person for the sake of argument, couldn't allowing it to continue to live be considered an act of minimal decency rather than some extraordinary act of heroism that we're not obligated to perform?
That's a crucial point of contention in response to Thompson's argument, yes. The question becomes, can we really classify ending the life of what we are assuming remembered to be a person as simply not being minimally decent?
Mm.
Or is it something more morally significant? Furthermore, the people seeds analogy itself has faced criticism. Some argue it potentially misrepresents the intimacy and sometimes the intentionality involved in sexual activity leading to procreation, comparing it to the much more passive act of, you know, breathing air or having open windows, except, as noted, perhaps in cases of rape where passivity or lack of consent is central.
These thought experiments certainly force us to confront some really fundamental ideas about rights and our obligations to one another that are quite powerful. Now, the lecture then transitions to the moral argument presented by Marianne Warren, who takes a quite different approach, as you mentioned.
Yes, Warren directly challenges the foundational premise that Thompson grants the idea that fetuses are persons in the first place. Her conclusion is stark. Because fetuses lack the essential characteristics of personhood, they do not have a right to life. This is a more direct and perhaps more commonly encountered line of reasoning in contemporary pro-choice arguments.
And her argument is structured as a logical syllogism, right? For listeners who might not be familiar, a syllogism is essentially a logical argument with, like, a major premise, a minor premise, and a conclusion, a structured way of reasoning.
Exactly. Warren's basic argument goes like this. Premise one, all and only persons have moral rights. Premise two, fetuses are not persons. Conclusion, therefore, fetuses have no moral rights. As the lecture points out, it's that second premise, the assertion that fetuses are not persons, that generates the most debate. Everything hinges on that.
So how does Warren define person in order to support that second premise? What criteria does she actually use?
Well, she defines a person as essentially a member of the moral community. And she employs another thought experiment, this one involving encountering alien life space travelers, to illustrate what characteristics we would intuitively look for to determine if these entities are persons like us, beings we ought to treat morally.
Okay, the space traveler test.
Yeah. From this, she proposes five key characteristics that are, in her view, central to personhood. One, consciousness, especially the capacity to feel pain. Two, reasoning, the developed capacity to solve new and complex problems. Three, self-motivated activity, activity that's relatively independent of genetic or direct external control. Four, the capacity to communicate messages of an indefinite variety of types. And five, the presence of self-concepts and self-awareness.
That's quite a list. And her argument is that fetuses at all stages of development lack these essential characteristics.
That is her contention, yes. She argues that at the very least, consciousness and reasoning, and possibly self-motivated activity, are necessary conditions for personhood. Since fetuses, particularly early-term fetuses, do not exhibit these traits in any developed way, she concludes that they are not persons.
Okay.
And therefore, following her first premise, they do not possess a right to life, thus granting pregnant individuals the moral right to choose abortion in essentially all cases.
This line of reasoning seems to open the door to some potentially uncomfortable implications, and the lecture definitely touches on one of the most significant criticisms leveled against Warren's argument, the issue of infanticide, the killing of newborn infants.
Indeed. That's a major challenge. Critics point out that Warren's criteria for personhood, particularly the lack of fully developed reasoning, complex communication, and a clear sense of self, could logically be applied to newborn infants as well. They don't really meet those criteria either, do they?
Right, not fully.
The lecture notes that Warren does address this directly, what some might call biting the bullet. She suggests that, strictly speaking, under her definition, infanticide might not violate the infant's rights because it isn't technically a person yet.
Wow.
However, she attempts to mitigate this by arguing that it is wrong for other reasons, primarily because it's not a practical concern in most societies. There are almost always others, parents, family, adoption agencies, who desire to care for unwanted infants, so killing them would deprive these potential caregivers.
That's certainly a very controversial aspect of her argument. To put it mildly, it feels like a difficult position. And there are other criticisms of her reasoning presented in the lecture, too, particularly concerning the distinction between necessary and sufficient conditions for personhood. Can you elaborate on that?
Yes. Her space traveler illustration is critiqued for potentially confusing what are sufficient conditions for personhood with what are absolutely necessary conditions.
Mm-hmm.
Let me explain. Just because certain characteristics like the five she lists might be enough to qualify an entity as a person, they are sufficient, doesn't necessarily mean that an entity must possess all or even some specific set of those characteristics to be considered a person. They aren't proven necessary.
Okay, so sufficient means if you have this, you are definitely a person.
Mm-hmm.
But necessary means you must have this to be a person.
Exactly. The lecture uses the examples of, say, oxygen being necessary for most combustion we see, but it's not the only way to produce light or heat. Or being born in the U.S. is sufficient for citizenship, but it's not strictly necessary. You can become a citizen through naturalization.
Got it.
So the argument against Warren is that her listed criteria might be sufficient markers of personhood, but perhaps other beings lacking some of those traits. Maybe someone in a temporary coma or even a fetus could still qualify as persons based on other factors like potential or inherent human nature.
And finally, the lecture raises questions about her fundamental distinction between the terms human and person, a distinction that, as you said, is often kind of taken for granted in these kinds of discussions.
Exactly. The lecture challenges the common assumption, which Warren makes, that person is a subset or a more restrictive category within the broader category of human being. It suggests we pause and think, what if person is actually the broader category?
Broader. How so?
Well, maybe it encompasses human beings, but also potentially other beings, whether real or hypothetical, like, say, a divine being, angels, or highly intelligent extraterrestrial life. They wouldn't be human, but we might consider them persons.
Okay, I see the alternative view.
If we consider that being biologically human automatically equates to being a person, that human is a type of person, then fetuses, as biologically human entities from conception, would inherently be persons from a very early stage of development, undermining Warren's entire argument. It questions that initial split she relies on.
So we've covered a significant amount of ground here, exploring these two really influential moral arguments for the pro-choice position as they were presented in the lecture, Thompson and Warren, and also considering some of the key criticisms that have been raised against them.
We have. Thompson's thought experiments, they really compel us to think deeply about the relationship between a right to life and the right to control one's own body, bodily autonomy, as well as the extent of our moral obligations to others, even if they are persons.
Mm-hmm.
Warren's argument, on the other hand, forces us to confront the very definition of personhood and what criteria we believe are essential for an entity to have moral rights, especially the right to life. It's a very different angle.
And as we've discussed, both of these arguments have sparked considerable ongoing debate and continue to raise profound ethical questions. It's clear that these are foundational philosophical viewpoints that, you know, continue to shape how we understand and discuss the issue of abortion today.
Precisely. Engaging with these arguments, even if we don't ultimately agree with them, pushes us to grapple with fundamental concepts like personhood, rights, potentiality, and the scope of our moral responsibilities in the very specific and often difficult context of pregnancy and the developing fetus.
So as we bring this deep dive to a close, here's a final thought for you, our listeners, to consider. Given these incredibly intricate philosophical viewpoints we've just discussed, stemming from Thompson and Warren, and considering the biological realities of human development we touched on earlier, where do you think the most challenging ethical questions truly reside when we consider the beginning of personhood and that delicate, often conflicting balance between competing rights and deeply held values? Something to mull over.